Eurovision. It's one of the world's longest running and most popular shows on TV. It gave us icons like ABBA, Celine Dion, Conchita and many more. But it's not just cheesy songs and saucy costumes. Eurovision is also deeply political. At least that's what I'm told by my boss and Eurovision superfan, Fraser Nelson. He joins me now to persuade me, a sceptic, of the show's importance, together with Dr. Paul Jordan, an academic who has written extensively on the competition, also known as Dr. Eurovision. Is that right, Paul?
That is correct, Cindy.
So, Fraser, just to start with you, give me your pitch for Eurovision. How exactly is it more than just trash TV?
It is a wonderful collision of music, culture and politics. The most watched television show in the world that isn't a sporting event. And you can see these things come together. You can see small countries try to present a face to the world. And they know that they've got the world's attention, tens of millions of people, for just a few minutes. So what do they want to say? So you can see through their songs what they want to present to the world. You can see in the voting what countries think of each other. You can see fights being picked. You can see hatchets being buried. And I mean, sure, it is entertainment. It's, I guess you could call it cabaret, or Schlager is the German word for it. Brits do tend to turn down their noses at it, but there are also 7 million Brits who watch it. So I'm struck by how many of people I usually hang out with in Westminster it's kind of laugh at Eurovision and think it's all a big amount of cheesy fun, where in fact there is so much you can gain. You can probably learn more about European politics watching one night of Eurovision than watching a year's worth of debates in the European Parliament. And that's why, you know, you get academics like Paul who are writing proper academic articles about the wider importance of Eurovision.
Paul, you've also written a book on the topic. Can you, before we go on to talking about the thesis of your book, just give me a few examples of how Eurovision has been political in the past.
Well, politics comes into the contest like it does any other large-scale international event. So whether it's the Olympic Games or the World Cup, Eurovision is no different in that sense. But I don't think politics actually decides the winner. So I think it's really important to say that. And if it was so political, I don't think we would see the contest in Israel after they won both the jury and the public vote. But definitely there's politics, you know, countries use it as a form of nationalism in a sense. So if you look at Azerbaijan and Armenia, the two are arch enemies. They were a state of war in the 90s over an area called Nagorno-Karabakh. It's a disputed territory. And in 2009, it was in Moscow, and the postcards, the little videos which depict each country before the singer takes to the stage, depicted a monument which is in Nagorno-Karabakh, and it was in the Armenian postcard. Now, because Azerbaijan disputes it, they've actually asked for it to be removed, and it was. And then in the voting, it flashed up. The Armenians decided to put a big clipboard with a picture of that very statue, basically saying, this is actually Armenia. So you've got a kind of example of politics coming in then. And then as a retaliation, the Azeris allegedly arrested 42 people for voting for Armenia. So definitely there's politics there. But you also look at Greece and Turkey. There were tensions over Cyprus. And yet, when the island came together a little bit more, they started voting for each other. But probably the greatest example of politics, I would say, is Ukraine. Back in 2005, they hosted the contest shortly after the Orange Revolution. Now, in order to attract more visitors to Ukraine, they lifted the visa embargo on EU nationals. Now, that was for 3 months, specifically for Eurovision. And that is still in place today. So there you have an example of Eurovision actually changing a country's foreign policy.
Fraser, how does that politics get into these musical acts? Are the musicians themselves inherently political, or is it just so much of the zeitgeist of their nation that it just comes through?
It's a little bit of both, I'd say. I mean, for example, it's always hard for Russia to do well because there is so much anti-Russian sentiment, especially amongst the former Soviet countries who were quite pleased to be free of their former colonial master. So 3 years ago, the Russians had this very strong entry in Thunder and Lightning by Sergei Lazarev. Now, that would have won had it not been for the Ukrainians who'd come up with a song about how much we don't like Russia, and it was about Russian occupation. The first line of the song was, they come into your house in the middle of the night and they kill you. And that won, not because it was a brilliant song, because it did very well amongst people who aren't very keen on Russia. Similarly, when Norway did well, it managed to game the system because it hoovered up the Scandinavian votes, Norway always does, but it also had as its singer a Minsk-born Russian. So when he played a Slavic tune, he got the Slavic votes too.
But as a voter, you're not voting politically, presumably, or surely you're just voting for what puts on a good show.
I think everything is kind of political in
a
way.
It's very Marxist.
I mean, if you are a Polish voter, the odds on you thinking highly of the Russian entry are not too huge. The same was true for Greece and Turkey for quite a while, although less so now. It used to be the case that Germany used to give Turkey no votes at all until they opened televoting. And then members of the German public, a good number of whom are Turkish migrants, ended up voting for the Turkey song.
Paul, and what you mentioned earlier about how Eurovision is a way for nations to express their own message on a world stage, I mean, that's the thesis of your book. And I'm interested, how did you come about researching this academically, and what gave you the idea to write a book about it?
Well, it was a bit of a kind of happy accident. At the time, I was a student of politics at Glasgow University, and it was just shortly after Ukraine had won Eurovision, and it had become very politicised after the Orange Revolution. And I was interested in the way in which Ukraine was using it as a platform for showcasing a friendlier face to the world. If you think about Ukraine before that, there wasn't really any good news stories. It was all about Chernobyl or corruption. And Eurovision was an opportunity, really, to showcase a new face of Ukraine, if you like. So then I started doing a bit of research, and it was actually my tutor at the time suggested I write my undergrad dissertation on this. I did, and then it became, when I did more and more research on it, it became much more deeper, and he suggested I actually apply for a PhD scholarship. And so that's how I got into my involvement with Estonia. And for Estonia, it was a huge opportunity for them. And the government actually backed it financially because they saw the value in hosting this event. They're never going to be able to host something like the Olympic Games, but Eurovision was the next best thing. And for a country that doesn't get often seen on the world stage, doesn't often have an opportunity to speak in their own terms, it's a valuable opportunity. It's basically a 3-hour television tourist commercial for your country.
That's certainly the case for Israel. I mean, normally it's only in the news for reasons of conflict. Nobody ever really gets to hear about the other side of Israel, about how it's a kind of oasis of tolerance socially and culturally in a region which isn't exactly famous for it. And that's the other part of it. I mean, we always talk in this podcast about politics in terms of what politicians are saying and doing. But there is so much more to the way that countries talk to each other. The ever closer union of peoples is something that can happen with cheap flights, with electronic communication, and through the medium of music. And if you're European, there's something quintessentially European about Eurovision. The Americans just don't understand it. They don't get the camp and the cabaret, the kind of comic aspect to this. And you can see, well, I can't think of any other occasion where so many people in so many countries all around Europe and Israel and even Australia are watching the same thing, are tuning into the same program, or voting in the same kind of way. I think there is a great kind of unifying power of this, which vividly demonstrates the soft power of music.
And Paul, you've just come back from Tel Aviv. Tell us about what this year's competition has looked like so far. Has there been much politics?
Well, the contest is in Israel, so of course politics is never far away. But Tel Aviv itself is like a little bubble. It's like a party town. And Eurovision itself is a bubble as well. So you've got a bubble in a bubble. So it's definitely in Tel Aviv, the atmosphere is great. But yeah, there has been some discussions about the Israeli situation with the Palestinians. And I would say that, you know, it's a large-scale international event. Politics, as I say, comes into it. But it's a good thing that we're talking about that. If it wasn't for Eurovision in Tel Aviv, we wouldn't be having that conversation. And definitely, you know, you've got countries that have called for boycotts, Iceland and Ireland. That happens, and, you know, freedom of expression and fair play. But what's really important is to make sure that we're not actually holding up the singers and making them responsible. You know, we can't judge people by their governments. And I've got to say, the people I met in Tel Aviv were very fair-minded, and they were just delighted that people were enjoying their country and enjoying their city. You know, and it's really important as well, I think, to respect the artists, because they're singers, they're not politicians. And if they want to get involved in politics, absolutely fine. But contacting the Irish person's granny about her performing in Israel, I don't think that's on.
The other aspect of Eurovision is how it promotes LGBT rights. It's always a bit of a tricky issue if the contest is hosted by countries who are not famous for those rights, like Azerbaijan. I mean, I've never been to one of the contests, but Paul, you've been to a lot of them. I imagine LGBT fans are probably disproportionate in their presence.
Yeah, absolutely. And Eurovision is one of those events where you actually have to out yourself as a straight person, which is quite refreshing in a lot of ways. As someone who, you know, sometimes I have to come out to colleagues, you know, and, you know, it's fine. But Eurovision is the opposite way. And definitely it's worth remembering that Israel is the only country in the Middle East where it is legal and safe to be gay. And certainly for other countries, Russia, Azerbaijan, whilst it's not illegal there, it's very challenging. And having Eurovision there in a country that is not often gay friendly or friendly towards minorities, that's a challenge for them. And it's interesting to see how they negotiate that. But certainly it's opened my eyes and it's taken me to countries I would never normally think of going to. And that's why I love it so much.
I remember that Iran once recalled their ambassador from Azerbaijan in protest at the hospitality that Azerbaijanis were showing to the Eurovision fans. Again, that's another example of how Eurovision is sort of cultural. It is a great kind of beacon of tolerance and diversity. And if you want to host Eurovision, you have to kind of sign up to the values, the tolerance and diversity values that the contest brings with it. Now, that's not party political, it's not country political, it's basically progressiveness in general, and I think a huge force for good.
I think it's absolutely to the credit of the European Broadcasting Union who organise this event that they really do stand by their values. And so Fraser was mentioning there about diversity and inclusivity. Now, last year, the Irish entry had two male dancers performing behind the singer, and China were broadcasting the contest and they censored that. That's out with the rules, and the EBU cancelled the contract. So they stood by their own values, and I think that's absolutely to their credit.
And Fraser, just give us an idea of the runners and riders for this year's contest in Tel Aviv. Who are your favourites and who are the ones to watch out for?
I would watch out for the Netherlands, for Russia, Australia, Iceland is perhaps a bit of a dark horse, and Azerbaijan. Now, all of these entries have got spectacular staging, and I think that's one of the big differences this year. It's not just about the music, it's about how it looks in television. And people nowadays have got bigger televisions, and you can see that the smarter entries are really trying to fill the stage, making it look magnificent. So it's triumph of choreography, I think, as well as music.
Speaking of how it looks on screen, you've shown me the Iceland entry. Describe for us what the Iceland entry looks like and your thoughts on it.
Well, Paul saw it in Tel Aviv, so I'll maybe ask him.
Give us all the glory details.
Well, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say the word bondage, am I?
You absolutely are allowed.
Right, well, it's the most un-Eurovision song you can imagine. It's very, very heavy metal. Now, Lordi are the Finnish rockers who won in 2006. Now, they had a heavy metal rock song, but it had a chorus and it had, you know, key changes and pyros. This is none of that. This is very, very un-Eurovision-y. And the outfits they're wearing, they're in leather, they're in kind of bondage gear. It's very, very bizarre, but somehow it stands out. And they are a political group. I mean, they've made statements before. There has been a movement towards boycotting Eurovision in Israel, in Iceland. And they've managed to cleverly navigate that by challenging Netanyahu to a wrestling match. Now, of course, he's never going to do that, but they're making their political point in a subtle and, I think, quite a classy way as well.
I'd like to see that, Netanyahu in a fight with bondaged men.
I don't think I would.
And Paul, who do you think will win in the grand final?
Do you know, I've heard the song so many times and you tend to lose all sense of perspective. I think there is no outstanding song this year. There's not one that you think that's definitely going to do it. We had a few upsets in the semi-finals during the week. San Marino qualified for the second time ever with what I thought was quite a bizarre, fun, but unusual song.
And Fraser, who do you think will win?
Well, if it's not the Netherlands, then Sweden's got a pretty decent shout. I mean, if you close your eyes and imagine what a Swedish entry would look like, you might think of some kind of ABBA revival, blondes, something like that. But no, they've got the only black singer in the contest, John Lundvik. He is British by birth, but was adopted, was a Swedish athlete. Then he was a songwriter to the royal family in Sweden, incredibly accomplished musician who has written his own song, and he's got backing vocals, the Mamas, and it's a visible piece of great musical fun. But Australia, depending where they are in the running order, they've got to kind of witches on a pogo stick act, which sounds bizarre, but if you watch it having drank enough vodka, you'll think it's the funniest thing you've seen in your life, and you might be inclined to vote for it. So I think quite a lot is up for grabs.
So I'm going to go for either Sweden or Switzerland, but I think at the minute I'm veering towards Switzerland, and purely because I was looking around the arena last night, and there was a woman next to me who was sitting, looking quite frankly, a little bit bored at times. And she started dancing to that song. It's the first time she'd heard it. And so you kind of think, well, most people on the night on Saturday are going to be watching for the first time. So I think Switzerland, possibly Sweden.
Infectious. Fraser and Paul, thanks very much. I suppose I'll have to try to catch tonight's contest after all that. I feel pretty invested. And if you enjoyed this podcast, we'll keep doing them on Saturdays on subjects that are more than just Brexit and Theresa May's leadership prospects. So do keep tuning in. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next time.